Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Hello and welcome to Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today on the show, from the fantastic Peter Bjorn and John, Peter Murem is going to be here, and we're going to be talking about all sorts of punk stuff. This is a fun conversation. I learned about Swindy, a new subgenre I had no idea about. But Peter Bjorn and John are in the process of wrapping up their 19th anniversary, the 2025 tour for their classic third album, Writer's Block. You can pick up a reissue of this album at the shows, but I don't think you can get it anywhere else. Maybe they're probably going to do a store version at some point, I would imagine. So you can get a chance now to go check them out if you are in the Czech today and tomorrow. I think they're playing if you're listening to this episode of the day it comes out. So check them out if you are able to, because they are a unbelievable band, a very talented trio who have put out very different records over the years. And this is a great conversation. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Head over to peterbjornandjohn.com to find out about those dates and keep abreast about any other upcoming dates. There'll be links in the show's description as always. And that's it for me. Thank you again to the show booker and my producer, Tristan Abraham. He's also my brother. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. You can reach us at turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at turnedoutapunk on all those platforms. And now sit back, relax, and enjoy Peter Murem on Turned Out a Punk. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I was telling you just before this, I'm a fan of Peter Bjorn and John, obviously, but I wanted to go back and I've been trying to track down Piggy in the Middle music, but you have done a very effective job of scratching it from the internet.
I'm not sure who's done that. Someone, maybe the bass player. The bass player in the Piggy in the Middle, we started this band in you get some scoops now. I don't think this is that well known, at least not in English. I mean, it might be in some old Swedish interviews on some fanzine site or something, but we started that band in high school, and it was basically me and Bjorn, and we wanted to have like an indie rock band, indie pop band. But this was a music high school, and it was kind of hard to get people together that even knew what indie rock was, because they were playing like fusion and jazz and classical music. So the bass player, he thought we were going to do Indian pop because, you know, indie pop.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, at that point, I took sitar lessons because I was a Beatles fan. And I thought, yeah, sitar lessons. I just put it in as a joke because the second year you could apply for an extra instrument. So I just put sitar in there. And there was like an Indian sitar master living in that small town. It's really weird because he was married to a violin player from Sweden. So I took sitar lessons for a couple of years. So it must have been confusing for this bass player that I was also taking sitar lessons and we were going to play Indian pop. And yeah, you know,
And you do play sitar on the Stinking Socks records, right?
I did. Wow, you've done research.
Well,
Stinking Socks.
I love those Stinking Socks stuff. I'm really I think that they sound really interesting. They were a band that I was previously unaware of.
No, they were great. They were friends of ours from they lived this was like it was a town called Västerås, which is I guess it's like a semi-big Swedish town. Like none of the towns apart from Stockholm are that big in Sweden, but this is like middle ground. And I come from a really small village in a rural area, like a bit more northern. But there was no like music high school, or how you should say. So I applied for this school and went there for 3 years. And just by happenstance, Bjorn was in the same city, and his only link to that city was his dad moved there. Otherwise, he would probably have been in school with John up north. But Stinking Socks was just a band that was around. They weren't at the same school, but I think we saw them at like, shows, local shows, and we just started talking music and really, really funny guys. I mean, you're missing out on the Swedish on those records,
Yeah.
but no, it's fantastic.
I feel like with like I love like Swedish, well, music in general, but especially in particular punk. And I feel like unless they're singing in English, I'm only getting like half the story a lot of times with these bands. And even then, like it took me years to find out what reggae was. Like the rockers. Like I didn't know, but I'd heard it in songs. Like reggae, reggae.
Ragare,
Reggae.
ragare.
Sorry, apologies.
Ragare.
I'm gonna suck with pronunciation on this. I should apologize in advance for.
Ragare is like greasers, I guess. That you call about the greaser culture,
Yeah, Teddy
like
Boys, kind of like in England.
and especially the area I grew up in, they call it like the Texas of Sweden, because it's all these small villages, but everyone is out in the countryside. But people were obsessed with like Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and big American cars and greasing their hair back. It was kind of big thing when I grew up. So I saw Chuck Berry playing on like a big field in the middle of nowhere when I was, 11. I saw the Crickets, Buddy Holly's band, in a local village as well. It's really weird. Like this is like late 80s, early 90s, and these American legends are coming to my area. It's really, it's really weird. But that music is bit was big there. I don't know how it is now, but
It's
yeah.
interesting how like music, in particular, kind of like rock and roll, like Sweden took to certain sounds that would come out of America, and then they would be adapted to Swedish culture, and obviously completely unique in their reinterpretation of it. But like more than any other country, I find in Europe, there's like a natural connection, it seems, to like American rock and roll.
Yeah, for sure. And now also country, like proper country, is quite popular here now as well. So I think that has grown in stature in the last couple of years. But yeah, no, there's always been a lot of American culture. And I think maybe even more now. I think before we had a more European influences. I know in the 90s when I started playing in bands, it was a lot about the UK scene. It was a lot about that. So I think now it's even more Americanized.
You're from Mora. Mora?
Mura, yeah, Mura,
Mora.
yeah.
The only punk band I can think of from there is that punk band The End that put out one single in like
The End?
79.
I've missed that. I mean,
Really obscure. It's like a $300 record, $400 record type thing.
I was born in 76, so wasn't on my radar
We
at that
really young to
point.
be going to that The End show, I guess.
I can't remember like a lot of the big scenes. I mean, if you can talk about big scenes in a small town like that, but it was the rockabilly thing. Creedence was really big, like that sort of 60s 70s classic rock, and also a lot of heavy metal, and I guess later on almost like the rap metal thing, I guess, was popular there, or rap funk or funk metal sort of. But punk bands, I can't remember that many. I remember more from when you talked about Stinking Socks. I'm not sure I would call them a punk band. I mean, they have punk elements, but they're kind of all over the place. But there was like a big in the 90s, early 90s, there was something called Trallpunk,
Yes.
You know about
Kang Punk, Ra Punk, and Troll Punk are my obsessions to talk about on this show. They come up a lot.
that? Okay. No, there was actually a guy in the class under me in high school who was in a band called, this is obscure, Hydrogenium.
Oh, I don't know.
Hydrogenium.
You stumped me on that one. I gotta look at
Yeah.
that up.
But they were on Bird Nest. Do you know Bird Nest
Yeah, definitely
Records?
Bird Nest. Yeah, of course.
So there was a lot of those band on Bird Nest, like Lyckliga Kompisarna and Charta 77. Do you know that?
No, I
You
don't know
know
that
those
much.
band? No,
No.
okay. No.
I'm
But
like my
it's all in Swedish.
Yeah, like
You know, they all sing in Swedish.
I definitely know like Astacasta and like the Chatra Charta 77 Chatra
Yeah,
7.
Charta 77. Yeah, that's what I talked about.
Oh, that's sorry. I missed. I might.
And the Asalma, yeah, actually, it's the same scene. Yeah, it's the same era. And it's funny, the Charta 77
Charta 77,
band,
sorry.
yeah, they were behind that label, I think, Bird Nest. The singer was part of that label. And actually, this band we had in high school, the Indian pop band. Yeah, Pig in the Middle. I mean, that was Pig in the Middle. I mean,
Oh, yeah, of course.
of course, the guitar player in Pig in the Middle, that wasn't me, the other guitar player, he actually played bass in Charta 77 for a while.
Oh, that's
So it's
awesome.
all intermingled, you know, all the, and then later he started playing in Meshuggah. So
Oh, my God, I had no idea that connection.
yeah, no, I, yeah. It's yeah, it's all it's like small towns, like everyone's playing with everybody, but I never played in any metal bands or anything like that, but yeah. No, he was talented. I mean, to play in Meshuggah you have to be a really good bass player, and he was. So
That's why I think the Stinking Socks to me were really interesting because, like, normally when you hear someone doing that kind of music, like a Pavement sort of band,
yeah.
like there's a striving for ineptitude in the playing, or there's like just sort of like a laissez-faire to the way people played. But everyone in Stinking Socks can play, so the band sounds super tight. Do you remember the first time you heard about punk or came across the genre?
I think it was probably in junior high, because I as we talked about the raggare and the early rock and roll, I was quite into that. I never had like the haircut or anything, the greaser hairstyle, but as a kid, I was really into early rock and roll and rockabilly. And then I got into 60s rock and 60s pop when I started playing guitar. But I think it was in junior high, I had a classmate who actually came from Stockholm and had moved up there, and he was into punk, and he started talking about like the Clash and the Ramones and like the classic bands, and lent me some CDs and stuff. I mean, this was when the CD was a thing. So I think that was kind of when I started like connecting to, and then it was all for me like the classic, you know, like the CBGBs and the early UK bands, like the classic ones. But and me being sort of like always leaning towards like poppier elements, I of course got into The Jam and Elvis Costello, which isn't punk, but I mean it's got the energy, you know, and yeah.
I think it definitely is. Like
So
that to me, like I think the punk thing, eventually gets codified as being this is punk, this isn't punk. But that early wave of British stuff, there's like Throbbing Gristle in there. There's the, as you're saying, the Jams in there. There's everyone's kind of like, I think it's just, to me, it's like the rejection of the rules of music and just kind of like when you're a kid being told like you can just do whatever you want and anyone can do this.
And even looking further back, looking to CBGBs and that scene, I mean, that was called punk, but I mean,
Yeah,
the original
exactly.
punk, and what was punk with that was just the Richard Hell's hairstyle that Malcolm McLaren nicked for Sex Pistols.
And the
That was
safety
kind
pin
of,
shirt he was stole from them too. Yeah.
but I mean, looking at the bands like Ramones, Talking Heads, Blondie, Television, I mean, it's all over the place, and in my world, that would be, you know, the perfect idea of punk.
Yeah.
Because when it's all about the leather jacket and the spiky hair and it's like a cliche, then I don't know. I mean, it's kind of, you know. And if you look at it like that, then you can go even further back and find punk stuff from the earliest days of rock and roll, like
100%.
just freaky stuff, you know, like
Yeah,
out of the
like,
box. Yeah.
yeah, and I think like if like look at Devo, right? Like and
Oh,
those
yeah.
guys who definitely were punk, you know, like Mark
Yeah.
Mothersbaugh was on
Yeah.
this podcast talking about how much he identified with punk, and it was like there's no rules with Devo. Like that doesn't sound like you're saying, like none of those CBGB bands sound alike, and that's what makes it such a cool scene.
And I'm guessing the idea how punk should sound that came later, I guess. It came like, I don't know, like the second wave of bands
Yeah, like
or
I think
like
it was Sounds Magazine doing the stuff with Oi and really pitting like Oi versus Peace Punk, and it was like felt like I think it makes it easier to sell and market people when you can be like, oh, this is the thing. It sounds like this, it looks like this, here's what you need to buy, versus anything can be it. Like you can dress any way you want. There's no uniform. There's like So when you went, because you move and you go to that music school at a certain point, like, did you have any bands prior to Piggy in the Middle?
Not a proper band. Like I was sort of like troubadouring, playing pizzerias, you know, playing covers in pizzerias, and sometimes I had like a pickup band, you know, like I played with my music teacher's friends at the summer thing or whatever, and I guested with the local rock bands, just jumping up on stage and stuff as a kid. But I mean, I didn't have my own band, so no, it was probably Piggy and Mill that was the first band. And I would say we were, in a way, even though we were indie pop, we were quite punk because we definitely didn't have a proper genre set. It was very all over the place, in not always a good way. But yeah.
That lack of focus, though, is where the innovation comes, I find, right? Like that's where the experimentation comes in, and that's where you like it's when you're trying to sound exactly like another band or exactly like a certain scene, it's going to stagnate.
Yeah, 100%.
Did Piggy in the Middle tour at all?
I mean, we made our first demo in 92 or 93, and we immediately got a gig at the biggest rock festival in Sweden at that point, which was called Hultsfredsfestivalen. And on that same stage, that same day, this is, do you know Bob Hund?
Bob Hund. No, I don't think
No,
so.
no, no. They're a fantastic band, with like proper punk roots, but also a bit poppy, and they also have like two of the guys were synth guys to begin with, so they have like a Kraftwerk element mixed with like Stooges and indie rock and whatever. But they just started out then, and we played on like a demo stage on that festival, and they got their record deal at the same festival, like the day before or the day after, and they've been going on since then and been one of the most loved bands in Sweden, and they're making their last ever concert on Saturday. It was just funny when we talked about this that I just realized, oh, they've been going since then. Fantastic band. I'm not going to see the show. I kind of sometimes with people I saw like, you know, 10, 15, 20 times in the 90s, I like, yeah, I don't know.
You've got a perfect
I'm
memory.
done. I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, for sure. And there was also another guy playing that demo stage who was also in like a trallpunk band called Snoddas.
Oh yeah.
You know Snoddas?
Yeah, I've heard I've seen the single before.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
okay, cuz the singer in that band, he is now like one of the biggest stars in Sweden. Like he's a singer-songwriter, sort of like a Bruce Springsteen type of guy, and he sells out stadiums. Like he's huge. But that was how he started in a trallpunk band on the demo stage where Piggy in the Middle played as well. But we kind of that was kind of our peak. we started with on that stage, and then it went downhill. No, I mean we did some shows. We did a couple of records that no one bought, but it wasn't really happening that much, no.
It seems like that would have been kind of in the midst of, I guess, like the skate punk
Oh
explosion stuff that kind of
yeah.
happens in the mid-90s.
It was huge then, and it was actually a scene in Örebro with Millencolin and what's the other band? It was a couple of
Satanic
Swedish bands.
Surfers.
It's a couple of
And
Swedish bands that were quite popular around that time. Yeah.
there was that stuff actually got exported pretty heavily to North America too, because I guess Burning Heart had distribution with Epitaph, so find those
They
records.
even did Lollapalooza and stuff, right? No? Or maybe
Millencolin did the
no.
Warped Tour
Oh, okay,
a couple times, and Satanic Surfers did somewhere else. I find Nicola from Millencolin, his cousin went to high school with me,
Oh,
so
wow.
I was like, they were like one of my favorite bands when I was in high school. He's like, here, I got you
Wow.
a hat, I got you this thing. I'm like, that's amazing. But and also,
Yeah.
if and also, I guess Swedish death metal would be the other thing that's kind of exploding around then too, right?
Yeah, for sure. No, it was huge. I mean, the skate punk thing. I remember, like, even my sister were into Green Day and Offspring and that, and you know, but I was almost like too old. Like, it's I didn't. I was all over the proper indie rock thing by then. It's
Yeah, I'm
like.
like fascinated about that, how that sound arrives, because like that like it must be Bad Religion as the main influence
Oh
from
yeah.
talking to
That was a
people.
f
And but
yeah.
there's so many bands doing that style coming out of
Yeah,
Sweden.
yeah. Yeah. No. 100%.
Was it hard kind of like during that time being a band that's not doing that style? Like you're not doing death metal, you're not doing skate punk, like you're trying to occupy like another lane. Is it kind of hard to get gigs during that era?
No, cuz the we called it Swindy, which is like Swedish indie. It's a funny name, Swindy. No, that was quite popular during that time, like early 90s. Usually the only bands people know about all around the world is Wannadies and Cardigans,
Definitely.
but from that scene. But it was a lot of bands. It was a lot of bands from up north, where my dad came from, and where also Bjorn and John came from Skellefteå. So a lot of bands from there, and also bands from the South, and also at that point you had like a university scene. You could tour and play the universities. Like every university had like their own small clubs and stuff. And when we started Pete, Bjorn, and John later, we kind of did that thing. I think that started with to circle back to punk. I think that started with punk. It was something called Kontaktnätet, which was like an organization where they had like a different promoters around Sweden. You know, it's falling out of grace now. It's not around anymore. Now everything's gone so commercial. But back then it was kind of idealistic, and you know, small promoters starting up things from nothing in small towns and kind of connecting. And getting addresses and yeah, sort of like a grassroots movement. And I've heard similar things from when I've read books about the States. Like if you talk early 80s, like the hardcore scene and stuff, right? Like it's a similar thing. But I think in the 90s, those indie rock bands were kind of part of that. They kind of took over and played all those venues, and also the university venues. So it was actually a lot of places you could play, and also rock festivals. You know, like there's barely any rock festivals left here. We have a big one called Way Out West in Gothenburg, but not a lot of like proper small ones where you live, sit in the field and get muddy and sleep in a tent or not sleep in a tent. But it was a lots of those, like out in the countryside, out in the middle of nowhere, proper, you know, trashy rock festivals. There's a lot of that. So I would say the live scene was pretty healthy back then, because it was before DJs and a bit later, like all those venues where we used to play the university towns, they were all DJs, because it was
The Swedish
cheaper
House
to
Mafia
book.
moved in.
Yeah. Swedish, it's much cheaper to book them, you know, and like no amps and drums and shit. It was just a USB stick, and I was like,
I kind of like
yeah.
I'm fascinated by that like 90s period, because like you're saying, there's just there's was it Swindy? Swindy.
Swedish indie,
I love that.
Swedish indie, yeah,
A new
Swindy,
Swedish subsection for me to add to my list of musical genres. But
yeah,
there's just so much music happening. And I like a lot of people from Sweden who've come on this podcast have talked about the fact that you had youth centers that you know bands could play at, but you also had practice spaces, there were music schools, and you really see how if you feed kids this kind of stimulus, years later you're going to have like this incredibly important music scene that broke out of Sweden, like went all over the world.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it was a lot to do with like decent politics, to be fair. I mean, which is kind of going down the toilet these days, but it
That's a
used to be.
worldwide problem, I guess.
No, but for sure, like a lot of support, as you say, the youth clubs and you could play at school, practice at school, and yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah, and it feels like that, like you talked about, there was like sort of like in the 90s in particular, and going back to the 80s, there's sort of this like utopian. It's not anti-commercial because everyone's in a band and eventually you just want people to come see you play music. Like that's the end game. But there is a sort of like anti-commercial
For
utopian, we're
sure.
doing it for the music kind of vibe.
And also during the 80s, a lot of like indie labels started and printing up their compilations and 7 inches and stuff, and I guess that went into the 90s as well, but then you started seeing more and more like as in the UK and the States, like smaller labels getting bought up and merged with bigger ones, you know.
It, and I think like post Nirvana, certainly in America, underground music suddenly had a market value. Like the idea that these bands that were completely uncommercial could find, and I don't, not even just with the labels, I think even bands felt like that after that, like, oh man, this could be a job for me, and maybe not to the benefit of the music scene long term.
No, that was a big change. I mean, the Nirvana thing, that was when I was still in junior high. I remember that so clearly when they came. And I always liked them. I liked them a lot, but I never really got into any of the other grunge bands. Like, even though it's like a diverse scene, that's a problem with scenes again. It's like, what is it? What is grunge? I don't know.
Yeah.
Nirvana is kind of a punk band for me, you know,
Oh, 100%.
melodic punk band, you know.
Yeah, I think Kurt Cobain, like that's his whole life was kind of shaped by punk in a lot of ways. It seems like I never met the guy, but like just from what I've read and people I've talked to that knew him, and I think he 100% viewed Nirvana as a punk band. And I think that actually caused him a lot of strife later on when he had success, like how is this band still going to fit into the punk thing in a post Nevermind kind of universe for them? So yeah, I feel like all that grunge stuff kind of came out of punk. Like all those people had bands before, like people in Pearl Jam playing in hardcore bands and people in Nirvana. Like it was almost like that was the I like the I guess that was the Seattle manifestation of punk. You know, that was their version of it. So
Mixed with some metal and almost prog
yes.
elements for
Yeah.
some bands, right?
Yeah. But I think that's also because they were like you're saying about you know yourself, like to them there wasn't necessarily the codification around like this has to sound like this to be valid or proper or to fit into the genre. Like they were experimenting too and made some great music out of it.
For sure. And Kurt, I mean, yeah, and he was into a lot of like quite soft Scottish, you know, obscure bands like Vaseline's and
Yes.
stuff like that, which I really like, you know,
Same. The
like
Dolly
so.
Mix. My band did a Dolly Mixtures cover 7-inch, and we've done
Oh, nice.
Vaseline covers too. Like I love that. To me, that's punk too. Like that was their version of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you into the stuff from New Zealand at all, like the Flying Nun records?
I love that stuff. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
I had the guys from The Clean on the show, Rest in
Wow.
Peace Hamish, and they were like, we're a punk band. Like, this was
Yeah.
our punk. And like,
Yeah.
they had rockers that they didn't get along with that were beating them up. And they were like, why would we want to make tough sounding music? Those guys are the tough
Yeah.
guys. We want to make
Yeah.
something anti them.
True. I mean, how can you be more punk?
Exactly.
Like
Yeah.
that's Yeah, I mean it's the same with like I've been working quite a lot this last few years with Robert Forster from the Go-Betweens.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean I produced his last record. I'm gonna tour with him now in the Europe in the fall in about a month. I mean they were a punk band as well to begin with, at least. Even though they were always into like Bob Dylan and Monkees and 60s music, but they would never have become a band without punk. I mean, never. That was like the that's why they started playing and just those early punk bands. Otherwise, they wouldn't have got the idea, that you can do it.
That's the greatest gift punk gave, was the fact that it just told all these kids, listen, you don't have to wait till you're good
No,
at music to
exactly.
go do this. Just go do it and then become
Yeah.
good later on.
Yeah. And of course the thing is like the ramshackle qualities of those early records is I mean it's part of it that they can't play. That's the
Oh,
beauty of
absolutely. It's perfect.
it.
And there's almost something political in a band getting up there and doing it, even though they can't play yet. You know, there's like a resistance quality to it.
That was the problem with Pig in the Middle, that apart from myself, because I was never, I got into that music school because of that I could sing because I had a good voice, and they told me like there's not a lot of boys who wants to sing. It was only the girls who wanted to sing, but they thought my guitar playing wasn't good enough. But if you take some singing lessons, we can let you into the school. So basically, I was the worst musician in that band, and the other guys were quite good. Like technically good, but not maybe to me it didn't sound that good anyway because maybe they were too good or they hadn't like I mean you can be a technical player, but you still have to have taste. You have to learn how to sound. I think it took a long time for me to, sound the way I want to sound. Like sometimes you almost have to like turn off your brain and create something, start again, almost like, but I don't know. It's a mixture of course your fingers can create a better sound, but it's still you still want the rawness. That's kind of the tricky thing. When you can play, when you can play, but and you sort of have to create intellectually the ramshackle, quality. It's kinda,
That's why I'm fascinated by those punk bands that get like maybe two or three records in, and it's like, oh shit, what do we do now? Like, we all can play. We don't want to write the same stuff over again. And that's where you get some really interesting records, as bands are like desperately searching for, like, who are we beyond being amateur and perfect at it. It's definitely like, I don't know, like, there's a that that's the balance, like you're saying. Like, you want to get good at your instrument, but you never want to lose that search for your sound too.
Exactly. And I'm still searching, so it's a never-ending battle. But at least the good thing is that I was always like I was always the least good one. So I'm still thinking now, like at this point when I am pretty good.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Yeah, you figured it out. I'm going to say, from an outsider observer, you're pretty good.
Yeah, but I still have that, you know, little thing in my head. Like, I can't play jazz. I can't play fusion. I can't play heavy metal. I can't play that stuff that the other guys at school played. And I still can't play that stuff. But I'm starting to feel that, taking pride in that. Like I'm doing my own sound and my own version of rock and roll or pop or whatever it is. That's more valuable. And it's also quite maybe good some to have like, yeah, well, I'm quite crappy, which means that I don't care as much sometimes, you know, even though I'm not crappy. You know, like it's like
but I think that leads to innovation. That leads you to finding your own style, right? Like that leads you to creating something because you're not mimicking. Like there's tons of those people on YouTube that you can watch and they can do like the crazy guitar finger solos on guitar, but it's like I would not want to hear them make a whole fucking record.
No. That's the thing. You don't want to listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they might want to make it, but I don't want to hear it.
Exactly. Yeah.
At some point though, you switch kind of focuses to film, right? Though.
I guess like after the music high school, I realized that I wasn't good enough, or I wasn't willing to become good or whatever, you know, because I sort of had some problems with the teacher. There was a drum teacher who had like ensemble training, whatever you call it, like doing ensemble playing. And I was supposed to sing a Toto song. And I said, I don't want to sing this song. This song sucks. And he said, like, well, Peter, everything can't be fun in school. And I felt like, okay, well, why should I go to music school if it's not fun? You know, music should be fun. You know, it's my passion. And I also had like another teacher who laughed when I said I liked Bob Dylan. And they were, because the teachers were, they were so snobby. It was all about like West Coast and you know, maybe Stevie Wonder was okay, but not Bob Dylan. Like it was really snobby. And I think that has changed a bit when I talk to younger people who went gone to similar schools now. Like something has evolved, but this was like early 90s. The teachers were, you know, they didn't know anything about rock and roll or punk or anything. It was Toto. They knew about Toto and Sting.
Yeah,
you know, and I wasn't into that at all. So. I felt, and also I was really bad at reading music. I couldn't really read music. So I felt like I can't continue with any sort of music higher education. It's not going to work. I'm not going to become a jazz player. I'm not going to become an opera singer. So let's give this a rest. So then I moved to Stockholm and I just went to university to get money, you know. So I did literature. And then I did film studies and some theater studies, like theoretical, and also history. Like, you know, all like it didn't lead anywhere. It was interesting. It was really interesting. And then eventually I started playing bass in a band, actually, that was popular for a while, for about a year, called The Plan, which I know there's a German band called Their Plan or something, right?
I think there's also a plan from Canada too, The Plan as
okay,
well.
Okay. There's plans.
A few plans, a few bands with plans.
Yeah, exactly. But this was a guy from the singer in this band. He was in Broder Daniel. You know Broder Daniel?
I think yes.
From Gothenburg.
Yes, I think that does sound very familiar.
Yeah, no, they were really big for a while, and I guess they were sort of part of the Swindy scene, but it was a bit later, and they were really ramshackle. They were really punk in that sense, really like and quite like a mixture of punk and goth and indie rock, I guess, somehow. But they were really popular with like all their fans had like were dressed like pandas. They'd had like the eyeliner and they looked like makeup like panda bears. That's what we said, like pandas. But it was all like black clothes and I don't know. Whatever. He played guitar, or did he play bass in that band for a while? Anyway, and this was like his solo project, and so he was kind of got a good deal with EMI straight ahead because he wasn't a popular band, but it wasn't really a band. That was the problem. So I got hired to play bass. But the record label wanted me to be in the pictures anyway. It was sort of like a Milli Vanilli situation, like
Yeah.
the Swedish Swindy Milli Vanilli. So because I didn't play on the record, I only toured. But I did that for about a year when I was 25, 24, 25, and then he kicked me out of the band, me and the drummer. So. It was a short period in the sun, but at the same point, I did like I worked in the secondhand bookstore. I worked as a substitute teacher. I did all kinds of different stuff, and then sometimes went back and did some spare course I had at university. So it was, I usually say, like between 20 and 30, it was no plan. It was just like no plan, even though I wasn't the plan, but. But it was really like, but me and Bjorn always had things going on, like writing songs and doing stuff.
Because Peter, Bjorn, and John get together kind of while you're still in the plan, technically, right? Or is it after?
Yeah, it's actually, I think we even started before I got in the plan. Because I think Peter, Bjorn, and John got together around 99, 2000. It was basically me and Bjorn had the Pig in the Middle band, and we broke up that band and we moved to Stockholm. Bjorn actually did go to a higher, because he was playing jazz piano, so he started like doing other stuff in music and also started playing with other people. But for me, it was like I went to these schools and then I wrote songs in my spare time, and sometimes I played at parties, like rock and roll covers, back to the
Yep.
raggare thing. But Bjorn was kind of getting quite proficient in like studio sessions and stuff. But we always wrote songs, and then we met John in 99, I think, and he's the most advanced player. If I'm the worst player in the band, he's the most advanced, because he's a classical percussionist. Like he was sort of like a wunderkind. He went to the music the what do you call it? After
Like
what's
post-secondary,
the
like music
Yeah,
university, I
like,
guess,
yeah,
or
music university. Yeah, he went there like before his time, basically. He got in there early because he was so good. And then he played in orchestras and all kinds of stuff. So he was already a professional musician when we met him. But we started seeing him, and so we knew that he played marimbas and, timpani and stuff.
you'd have
But
no problem
then we
playing a
started.
Toto song if asked.
But then we started seeing him at like. Sebadoo, we went to saw Sebadoo and Elliot Smith and stuff, and he was at those shows, so that's why. Okay, is he into these kinds of bands? Yola Tango, so we talked to him, and actually we had a period when we tried out different drummers. My whole family just came into the room here, so I'm a bit
You got an audience now.
confused. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, don't worry. I got you. Might be hear my youngest kid running up and down upstairs. I can hear.
Yeah.
They were supposed to be out of the house today, but they're at home, and I can. I'm like, I wonder if that's going to pick up on
Oh
the mic. The
yeah.
herd of elephants above my head. So, you were saying
No,
about trying other percussionists out.
yeah, we had like actual yeah, we're trying out. We even like put out ads for drummers and stuff, and people calling up, and we had the rehearsal space, and we actually assembled a drum kit that we bought ourselves, even though we're not drummers. So we got them off like the Swedish equivalent of Craigslist. We bought a Japanese cheap kick drum somewhere, and you had to take a train for across the city. And we still have that kick drum. It sounds really good. It's on all the records, but it was really cheap. It was like, 100 Swedish kroner, like nothing. And we had a tom, like we assembled a kit. So we had a rehearsal space. We could bring different drummers there. And it didn't really work out, but then we got you on, and
It worked.
just right away it fitted. So it's perfect, even though he was this classical percussion guy. But yeah,
Did your
he could play
experience?
drums.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Now he could play drums. I mean, yeah.
Did your experience in the plan affect the way you were approaching your next project, like which I guess is Peter Bjorn and John ultimately?
Not really, since me and I think we started before,
That's
like,
true. Yeah, I
or
guess.
yeah. And the plan was just, this guy from Bror Daniel had written all the songs, and they even had recorded the album. So it was just like, and the fun thing was I was playing bass, and I always enjoyed playing bass, and I play bass on a lot of records, so it was fun because of that. I was playing bass, and I knew the drummer. That's how I got into the plan. And he is quite a, he knows a lot about punk, a lot more than me. He's a proper like punk guy, also free jazz guy. So it was a fun drummer to play with, to play bass with. But apart from that, like, I mean, Peter Bjorn Jon were mine and Bjorn's songs. So it's a completely different, it was sort of the continuation of Pig in the Middle in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like though it just feels so not the Swedish Milli Vanilli, like with what you guys are
Yeah.
doing. Like it feels very honest.
Well, if you heard the plan, it doesn't sound, I mean,
Not
it's
honest
quite
sounding, I guess.
no, it's actually a really good record. That first record is really good. And quite punky, and it's I'm circling back to the word punk here. I'm trying
It
to
comes
stay on
back.
target.
Yeah, don't worry. I'm getting it. It's a branding.
No, it's a good record. I mean, he's a talented guy, so it's nothing to do. The only thing about Milli Vanilli was that we had this meeting with the record label, which was Swedish EMI, so it was like a big deal, and they specifically wanted us to be like me to be on the in the pictures. They wanted it to be packaged like a rock band, and I always felt like, well, this is his solo project, like and there were even instances where he was hungover and called me up and like, oh, I'm supposed to do this interview, can you do this interview? Oh, okay, I'm gonna do the interview. Okay, so I sort of did interview talking about his songs, and then of course he got angry when I said something that was wrong about the song. It's like, okay, well, come to your interview
Yeah,
then.
exactly.
So, yeah.
Even like, because I heard about, I'd heard you guys, and the song was everywhere at that time. But it was, I was on tour with the Bronx, who were on Wichita
Oh,
Records.
yeah. Wow. What did you like?
I sing in a
Were
band called
playing?
Fucked Up. And so Fucked Up
Yeah.
was on tour opening for the Bronx on tour,
Yeah.
and I met Mark Bowen from
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Wichita,
of course, yeah.
and I went to the office and I'm like, oh my God, you guys put out this record grabbing your single. And he's like, yeah, they're awesome, they're really cool people. Like it felt like there was like, obviously things got so massive, but there's also like, I don't know, like it felt like you guys were trying to keep it indie in a lot of ways, or like the approach was anti-music industry in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, we started out very indie. Like the first EP we pressed by ourselves, that was 2001 or something. And then the first album and EPs was on a one-man label. The second album as well was on a Swedish label actually called Plan Economy, which is like the Marxist term for economics. What's the word in English? Whatever. It's very like small scale and quite leftist in a way. The label was, I don't know if we got any money though. So Yeah,
You contributed to
whatever.
the
That's what
collective,
it
though.
is. Yeah, exactly. So it was all very like super indie, I would say. And of course, then when we got signed to Wichita and to some other labels around the world, we still had that sort of an arty angle on things. And of course, the album that became big, that third record that you talked about, was done on a shoestring. I mean, it was done basically in a Bjorn had he rented a space here in Stockholm, Södermalm, close to where I live at that point. And it was not really even a studio. Like, it wasn't built to be a studio. It was just a room, you know, with no like padded walls or anything. It was just like a spare room with some instruments. And he had a couple of mics. He had some old tape echoes and stuff. And I remember even once when we recorded drums, I held like the mic for the snare, you know, stuff like it was so everything was simple. We used a couple of mics for everything. We like moved them around, and it's all kind of distorted, and it's going through that tape echo to make it gel and make it sound. I mean, it's quite a lo-fi record. We mixed it in a proper studio. We mixed it actually partly in the old ABBA studio. So it's like a expensive mixed in an expensive studio. But recorded really, really cheaply because we thought that was gonna be our last record. Because the first two didn't do that much, and we were all like hitting 30, so you know, let's give this a rest. Let's split up the band basically, and then of course, yeah. So
Everything
I think
happens.
that attitude stayed with us, and the first record we did after Writer's Block was an instrumental record called Seaside Rock. Which is really it's almost like a okay now we got an audience like fuck off audience
Exactly.
yeah because like because everyone was really confused because it's like monologues in Swedish and instrumental and I play violin and you know Bjorn plays a trumpet it's a really like I love that record and it's got some beautiful melodies and stuff I don't know if you heard it
I
Seaside
have heard,
Rock
yeah,
but
definitely.
yeah but it. Definitely people got confused that our manager was like ripping his hair and like what are you doing and then of course later on in the career we tried to do like singles and so we always had this you know it's good and bad in that we always had this balance of on one hand we're kind of super arty and weird and then on the other hand yeah okay but we need the single it's like it's always been that like even on the same records you know. And it's an interesting mix, but can sometimes wear and tear as well, like you know.
Well, it's as much as it must upset the management, like it's still like a really, but it's like that's the art, right? Like that's what you're trying to find your sound, you're trying to be honest and always present like an authentic representation of your creativity and stuff. And that's, I don't know, that's what I think punk is. Like, you know, it's not a sound. It's like that quest to present an honest interpretation of your creativity for people.
And always the other thing we always did was like every record sounded differently than the next. So the record we did after Seaside Rock, we had a lot of like almost like found sounds. Like we hit like music stands and used like balloons and scissors to create like a sample drum kit and stuff like. Everyone thought that record was full of synthesizers, but it wasn't. It was just like hitting pianos, like hitting things and building like a sound bank, basically. And it was very sparse, like almost a lot of songs didn't even have guitars or anything. It was like, you know, I have some trouble listening to that record. I think it's quite a hard listen because the songs are a bit too long and it's too many songs. But it is, in a way, it's very punk. You know, and then after that, because on that tour we brought, because we were going to be able to play all these weird sounds we created in the studio, we brought these huge keyboards with us that me and Bjorn took. We like switched who was going to play it on different songs, and they were so. I mean, this was 2011, no, 2009. So I'm sure there's like better solutions now, but back then it was, you know, a lot of troubles with these guys and I remember we did a show at Zappa's at West when that record Living Thing was brand new and something got fucked up with this keyboard And we couldn't start the first song, and people started booing, and it was like, so on the next tour after that, or the record we did after that, Gimme Some, then it was like, okay, we're never gonna bring a keyboard again, like never. So it's back to guitar, bass, and drums, and I mean that's our punkiest record, I would say.
Yeah.
Gimme Some, if you heard that
Oh,
one,
it's a fantastic record.
it's very like back to basics and sort of more like we sounded in the beginning, but a bit more extreme, because we always our live shows have always and still to this day, and that has a lot to do with me. I have to take credit for that. Like I'm quite a lunatic on stage. Like I can't stand still, and I always want to play the songs faster live than on records and stuff. Like I have to like calm myself down. Like I get this energy buzz, but it's always been. Since the day one, people listen to the records and they get things, there's nice melodies and all these cute pop songs. And then they come to the show and like, oh, what's happening here? Like weird guitar solo and he's screaming and jumping around. Like, well, see, it's like, it's always that, like, we've always had that thing. But on that record, it kind of went on the record a bit more than.
When you well, because you mentioned like Sebadoh early, and I think that's the thing with Sebadoh is like you listen to the records, there's melodies and stuff, but then you see, I didn't even get to see him back in the day, but like it's a crazy show. Like Lou is a crazy person up there, and it's amazing.
No, they were, I saw them in the 90s, as I mentioned. It was really good. But and it's also they have on the records too, they have these pretty ballads, but then they have a couple of like crazy songs in between, like short. That's the other guy, right? No?
Like it's
Or maybe they both.
they do it together, like they kind of like, what's I wish I I'm blanking on his name now. I'll fix that in the intro. But yeah, like I feel like they're a band that kind of like reminded people like you don't have to spend a ton of money recording these records. You don't have to do, be like the Replacements or Husker Du. You can just record on a little four track, and I think their influence is kind of underrated.
No, it was that whole like lo-fi movement, I guess, like mid late to 90s. It was quite a big influence on us when we started, because as I mentioned, when we like even earlier when we started playing in bands, it was that Swindie movement, and it was a lot of UK influence. It was a lot of like shoegaze and Madchester with the Stone Roses and all that, and also I really liked the early Blur stuff, which is also quite punky, but then something shifted, like, because I never liked Oasis, it
You're
was
not alone on that one. And you know what's so funny? Like, I don't want to. I the other day I was watching a TV show and they had a song by that glam metal band, Enough Is Enough, like ENUFZEUNF. They're like a terrible hair metal band from the 80s. And I'm like, this sounds exactly like fucking Oasis. And it hit me like, oh, Oasis was the glam metal, the British glam metal response to grunge. Like, this was like, it became important about how you dressed again. You had to have your hair coiffed a certain way. You had to present yourself with a certain level of bravado. It's like, it's the anti-Nirvana.
No, no, for sure, 100%, and not to like you can almost. It's a bit similar to the early, like we talked about the CBGB scene, because I mean the term Britpop is really weird to begin with. It's just some guy at the magazine that thought of it. But if you look at the early 90s British bands, sort of the indie bands, it was all over the place. Like different sounds from like the shoegaze stuff, the Madchester stuff, and then you had like synthy stuff and glammy stuff and quite experimental bands, like, and but after Oasis everything became like anthems and wall of guitars and just lazy rock songs and boring to my ears, and it kind of took over, and all that this more what's the word, eclectic scene, it kind of went out of the window, and so that's when I shifted. I kind of, okay, what's happening in the States, and got into all those bands instead. So it's like clears around 95, you know, when Oasis hit.
Yeah, because I feel like they have more in common with like Motley Crue and Warrant and Poison than they do with the Buzzcocks, the Smiths, and My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, for sure.
And if there was that, like you're saying, it is such a cool scene. And once again, all out of punk, like all these different bands, but like across the UK, there's no defined, like you got the Mega City Four at the same time you have Ned's Atomic Dustbin and then like all these other bands, and there's a real leveling that happens. But I guess that's when things get like what happened with punk, right? Like people are like, no, this is the thing. Here it is. It sounds like this. It looks like this. Buy it now. When you guys wrote Young Folks, was there like a, did you know immediately like this is gonna hit as a song? Because I'm always fascinated. I've had Dan Burt from Chumbawamba on, and I've had people from The Killers on. I'm always like, when you write a song that becomes like so just part of the culture, like it transcends like even just music to becoming part of just popular culture, do you know it right away? Is there like a different kind of feeling when that song's done? Like, do you know it's going to hit with a mainstream audience?
No, I at least I didn't understand it at all because it was just I did know it was different. I can say that much because it came pretty late in the process of the record. Like I think we'd done most of the songs before. So even this idea about whistling that everyone's talking about still, I think we've did that on a couple of other songs on that record. And we set out. It was the first record we did this with, maybe because we thought it was going to be the last record. So we set up some dogmas for the recording. And after that, we had dogma for every record we did, which is good if you're a band and you have to like trying to finish something. It's good to have some sort of rules around the recording. So I guess one of the rules was, okay, if we've used the sound on one song or two songs, might as well try it on the third song just to tie it together. So I think we've had whistling on a couple of songs before, like on Amsterdam, and it's even whistling on Objects of My Affection. Like there's a couple of whistlings that people don't think about as whistling, but it's there. That's not to answer your question, but it was different. I know that much. Like it didn't have any guitar. It's just one chord on the chorus. So I was kind of, okay, no guitar. What's okay? What I'm gonna do,
Just stand there.
which of course, every show I'm like with a shaker and looking stupid. I always had a problem with that back in the day, especially like, okay, I'm not gonna play because I've always had a guitar on, even as a kid. Even when I was 10, 11, I always, even when I sucked, I always had a guitar on, like Elvis or whatever. So, okay, I'm gonna take the guitar off. That feels really, scary. It's like I'm stark naked on stage. So that was something I had a problem with, but I mean, it was just different. It had like that funky drum thing. We said it was like a goofy, it's like a club song for geeks, like for dorks, because it's not a macho song, but it's still kind of clubby. So then of course we decided on this that it was going to be a duet, and we wrote the lyric from that angle, about a couple like meeting in a bar or a party, and of course the twist is that it's not about young people, it was about people our age, and we weren't. I mean, compared to now, we were really young, but at that point, I thought I was getting old, so it was not about someone meeting their first love. It was about someone has been in a couple of relationships and was a bit burnt out on love. That was kind of the idea. But then, of course, we put this cartoon video to it, so it's all really confusing. With kids in it, so it's kind of what are you saying? It's like,
Well,
yeah.
you mentioned having dogmas for the record. And I guess like Dogma 95 in film, like this idea of having like a certain like parameter to approach it. I guess that would always give each recording experience like a unique feel, and it forced you to have a unique approach and take you out of your box every time.
No, I think it's really helpful, especially if you're a band, and everyone is like Peter Björn Jahn is all was always a very democratic and sort of collective like that, and built on compromises for better and for worse. But I mean, if you're gonna go in with it like that, and everyone's writing and singing and producing, you have to have some sort of rules. Otherwise, you would never finish the record. And we had one record that we did later that didn't have any production dogmas. We said the dogmas were going to be in the songwriting for that record. It's called Breaking Point. And that was a really hard record to finish because of that, I think. Because we had like outside producers, and we had, it went on for years. We went like recorded in London, we recorded in LA. It was so expensive. I don't know what happened. It was like someone wanted to lose money. I think that was the idea behind
True
that
anarchy.
record.
You had
Yeah,
no dogmas
exactly.
to adhere to.
Yeah, we made some money. Let's throw them away.
Yeah, let's
That's a
burn it
good
all.
idea. Yeah, exactly.
KLF style.
So I think dogmas are good, you know. And even now, if I make solo stuff, I try to have some sort of frame, you know, some sort of idea around it. Otherwise, I don't know how to finish things. I think it's good.
Yeah, look at that. I think that would remove it from the indulgence of it, like
Yeah.
having this dogma to kind of keep you on track so you don't, because it's such a self-indulgent thing, making
Yeah.
music for other
Yeah.
people,
Yeah.
that we need, otherwise we're doing Toto, you know, we're all going to be in Toto. I gotta that drum teacher yelling at you to sing that Toto song though has like a Yola Tango, but you know that Yola Tango rock school video where they have to go to music school? It's like Toto, it's like no one should be forced to listen to
No.
that.
And I still can't listen to Toto. And I mean, my taste has broadened. I can appreciate a lot of music in lots of different genres. But still, you know, Toto, I get like, I want to scratch myself. I know the musicians plays on a lot of great like classic rock records and soul records and stuff. So it's not about that I look down on pristine musicianship. It's just that combination of with their songs,
Yeah.
you know. So it's not the slickness by itself. It's just like I don't think their songs are any good, and then it becomes like too much, you know. I guess.
Well, that's what if you develop an appreciation for Toto, maybe you've gone too far at that point. You're like, no, I need to go back to that raw amateurness, you know. Much
For
better be
sure.
going on tour with the Go-Betweens than learning how to play Toto songs.
Absolutely.
Peter, anytime you want to come back on this podcast and talk about Hartrath 77, or was my pronunciation slightly better that time?
Carta. That's
Hartrath.
how we Carta 47. That's how we say
Okay, anytime you want to come on here
it.
and talk about them or any of these bands, you are always welcome.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I might take you up on that.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.